maybe early in the morning.
But it's always time to go exploring. Welcome to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We broadcast from the UBC Vancouver campus, which is situated on traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Halkomelem-speaking Musqueam people. Although our recording studio sits on campus here, our listenership extends through to those situated in lands traditionally inhabited by the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coast Salish peoples.
Hello.
Hey, Sarika, it's Jade. Here on ODP, we talk to folks who love being outside. Today, we have the honor of speaking with someone who studies our world with great care. Sarika Kula Suzuki is a marine biologist who grew up locally here in Vancouver. Her father, David Suzuki, has been fighting the good fight for a long time. We talked to her about her path to get to where she is today, stepping into her father's shoes as the new co-host of The Nature of Things. The Nature of Things is one of the longest-running docu-series out there. Please check it out on CBC Gem. And just remember, folks, there would be no outdoor pursuits without the outdoors. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Sarika Kula Suzuki. I am one of the co-hosts of The Nature of Things. New season just started this January 2024. And I am also an alumni of UBC. I did my master's there in the fisheries department quite a few years ago. And I also volunteered at CITR, so I'm a huge fan.
Awesome. We are honored to have you here today. Can you share a little bit about your background and journey in the field of marine biology and how that led you to environmental activism? Because we know, you know, listeners probably know your dad, David Suzuki, who is very influential in the field of biology as well.
Yeah. And he was a professor in the zoology department many decades ago. So, yeah, lots of links there. Absolutely. So I did my undergrad in marine biology. And I always, like, when I was in high school and stuff, the classes that I was good at were the arts and writing and that type of thing. But science really captivated me. And I grew up by the ocean my whole life. I was born and raised in Vancouver and was always drawn to the sea. And back then, my parents in the summertime would take me and my sister camping in the BC provincial parks. And this was such a wonderful way for us to be in nature, go fishing, swimming, hiking. And it was always revolving around water. And I remember when I was 6 years old and I said to my mom, I'm going to be a marine biologist. You can be my assistant. Like, I just had this idea in my head. Anyway, so fast forward to when I go to college, and I just had this feeling. I'm like, I still want to do marine biology. And this was an amazing period for me because I was able to learn how to scuba dive, and I started conducting my first experiments, underwater experiments, and doing field work. And I was able to, through my university, go to different places and go to some tropical areas, some coastal areas, and get to know the ocean. And it was a really wondrous time. And as soon as my undergrad finished, the same month I started a master's program, and that was at UBC.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, because I was so fired up. I was like, this is what I want to do. And that's when I started at the fisheries department. I think it's called Institute of Ocean Science now. And my mentor was Daniel Pauly, who's still there, and he is such a hero to me.
Shout out.
But yeah, exactly. This is when things kind of hit home and everything changed, because I was doing a global study on the effects of fishing on the high seas. The high seas are areas of ocean that are beyond national jurisdiction.
Right.
So they have always been considered, they're so far out there. You know, they're over 200 nautical miles out there. Nobody can touch them. And what I saw was, through my research, oh my God, not only are we touching them, we're completely overexploiting these parts of the ocean.
Right. And was
and
that
so ev-
Sorry to interrupt. Was that partially because there's less legislation around that area, like in the high seas, just because it's out of everyone's jurisdiction?
Yeah, exactly. So there's not really people who are monitoring that area. And the people who are tasked to monitor that zone are the fishermen, because they're the people out there. So that clearly, there's a conflict of interest there.
Yeah.
And so I was crunching these numbers and doing this research, and at the end, I was able to present my results at the United Nations headquarters in New York.
What an honor.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
It was such an honor as a student, right, to be able to do that. And it was the first time that I'd actually spoken directly to industry. And I didn't know that everyone in the room pretty much was one of these organizations that were the fishing groups out there. And they were so mad at my findings. It was quite unbelievable. They basically criticized me for an hour and a half after my 10-minute talk.
Oh,
and
man.
They were trying to say my data was flawed. And the whole time I said, I got this data from your website. Like, there's no, I'm not hiding anything here. But it was all the fisheries data that I went through. And anyway, that was so eye-opening for me. But also, when you do a global study and you're reading day after day all the different ways that the oceans are being harmed, it's pretty overwhelming. And at the end of that time, I just felt really down, you know, because I just felt like this is such an enormous problem. And it's not just overfishing. It's ocean acidification and warming waters and pollution and invasive species. Like, it just, there's so many problems, right?
One leads to another, I'm sure, in some ways.
Yeah, everything's connected, absolutely. Yeah. And I remember going into Daniel's office and saying, this is so overwhelming. How do you keep going in the face of such enormous problems? And he kind of thought about it and he said, I'm just trying to work on one piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And if enough people are working on the other pieces, then one day we can put that puzzle together. And it was a really, I thought it was such a beautiful way.
That is a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah, it is, because you're not saying, I'm going to solve the world's problems. Yeah. That's impossible. But you're saying, I'm going to try to do my best on one part. And I know that other people are also working on this. So that's a wonderful way to think about global issues.
Yeah, that's great. So this issue on the high seas, did that kind of lead you, because you took your PhD as well, is that right?
Yeah,
and so, that was on noise affecting fish?
Yeah, exactly. So when I finished Daniel, I was really kind of like, okay, this global stuff is so important. I saw firsthand, you know, I was able to make those arguments and talk to industry and all that.
Shake things
but,
up.
Yeah, well, I hope so in some small way, but it really also took me away from the ocean, ironically, because I was, you know, crunching numbers on the computer and I wasn't interacting with the ocean anymore. Yeah. And I realized I wanted to keep studying, but I needed to go back to that source of inspiration. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it really was about getting back in the water. And I was really interested at that time on noise and how it was affecting ocean life. And then when I started, there was research done on marine mammals, so whales, a little bit of pinnipeds, like sea lions and seals and stuff, but nothing else really at that time on fish. And so I was talking to some colleagues and they were like, yeah, we need to do some research. And I started looking into it, and there was a species of fish, or there is a species of fish called the plainfin midgeman, which is a type of toadfish. And they're found from Alaska all the way down to northern Mexico. And this fish sings. And it just blew my mind. Like, well, I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you could find it all up and down the coast here off of British Columbia. And there was a beach that I knew very intimately. I've been going there my whole life, and it was full of these fish.
Oh my gosh.
And I just felt, I felt like, wow, I know nothing, because this beach I've been going to my whole life, and I had no idea that it was full of this fish. And I must have heard it singing, because they're so loud. Their voice will actually resonate out of the ocean and into the air.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you go down to the water's edge between like 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., these fish, if they're there, they're just singing away. And in groups, it sounds like a room full of people humming.
Whoa.
So it's like a hum, and it goes on for hours. It's really beautiful. But I must have heard it all these years and then just attributed it to something anthropogenic, like a
Motor humming or,
generator or a twin otter, you know, boat. Yeah. So that's
Wow.
when I decided, okay, I'm gonna study this fish. I'm gonna look at the effects of boat noise on this fish in particular, and that was a great experience because, you know, I was able to ask a pretty important question, I think, and also do some primary data collection on the fish, which
Right.
was
Wow.
fantastic.
Well, that's quite spectacular. That like so did you knew the habitat of this fish was kind of where you had grown up. Is that
Yeah.
right? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so I had
That's
this
an interesting small world moment in a special
I
kind of way.
know. Yeah, it was one of those beautiful moments where you're just like, wow, I thought I knew something and I know nothing, you know?
Right.
And which is constantly what happens in the ocean and in nature anywhere, but it was great. And so I had this underwater camera that I would put in front of their nest and an underwater hydrophone, which is an underwater microphone. And then I had it was cabled, so that means it goes through a cable into I built a little my dad helped me build a little platform actually, and I had like I guess a computer, a VCR, which had like VHS tapes in it, and I would just record, and so I could see in real time and hear in real time what was happening with these fish.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess kind of given your background in marine biology, it seems like you connect with the outdoors through the water and through everything that lives underwater. Do you often go out just for pleasure, like scuba dive or snorkel?
Yeah, so since I had kids, actually, I haven't gone scuba diving, but this year I'm getting back into it, which is really nice. But I've snorkeled my whole life, and I actually learned to snorkel before I could swim because I couldn't swim without my head being in the water, and so my mom put like a snorkel mask on me, and she's
How
like,
things
okay,
have
problem
changed,
solved.
eh?
So yeah, and now it's cool, like I've taught my kids how to snorkel, and I just find it such a wonderful way to interact because like swimming is always so great, you
Yeah.
know, physically, emotionally,
Yeah.
it's so immersive. And then once you put your head in and you can see everything, it's like, oh my God, this is
Yeah.
such a game changer. And it's nice because you don't need all the tanks and all the gear, which I
Yeah,
sometimes can
totally.
get in the way of that. Yeah.
Yeah, so your specialty, is it kind of intertidal zones or is it extends past that?
Yeah, I mean, for my PhD, I was in the intertidal zone the whole
Right.
time. So the fish actually, they live in hundreds of meters depth normally, but in the summertime they come in to lay their eggs and spawn,
Okay.
and they come super shallow right into the intertidal, and they hang out under rocks. That's where they make their nest. But when
Okay.
the tide recedes, they're completely exposed to the air. And one of the amazing things about this fish is they can actually breathe for a short amounts of time,
Wow.
hours actually. Yeah, outside of the water. So even though they're exposed to air, they can still survive.
That's quite incredible. I'm sure you're
Totally.
discovering a lot of other incredible facts throughout your journey on the nature of things. I got the chance to watch your episodes and they're pretty awesome. They're like super
Oh,
great.
thank you.
Yeah, I didn't know that there were great white sharks on the east coast of
Isn't that?
Canada. That's
Yeah,
crazy.
I know.
Like that's yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know that part of Canada very well at all. And so I too, when I learned about that, was like, wow, this is really amazing. And then to know that there is that, you know, like the indigenous connection, that
Yeah.
there were great white sharks there thousands of years ago and they had a relationship with them, I had no idea, you know. And so this is just, I thought it was a really cool film.
Yeah. Kind of through your new position on as co-host, how do you plan to maintain kind of a diverse and inclusive environment for everyone you interview?
So the reason I stepped away from science, it was kind of an interesting moment for me, because when I finished my PhD, I realized, okay, I love science, but the urgency of the ecological crisis was just, it was so palpable, you couldn't look away from it, right? It was just everywhere, and I needed to do something that was more urgent, that was more immediate. And so for me, that was media, because even though it can be vulgar and there are a lot of problems with it, it is instantaneous.
Yeah.
And most people today have access to media in some form or another, whereas science can be very inaccessible. You know, the language that scientists use, the fact that it's still mostly done in institutions or labs, there is a barrier there. And so I made a very real effort at that point. I was like, okay, I need to move more into science communication. And right. It was an unbelievable timing-wise that at that time the position for the co-host of the Nature of Things was coming up. And so I really felt like this was a marrying of my passions, which are science, communication, and nature.
Wow.
So that's kind of how I made the shift.
Right.
A lot of luck timing-wise, but also it was definitely, I will always be a lover of science, and I think I will always do it in some capacity,
yeah.
But right now I'm more focused on the communication side. So anyway, I just wanted to finish up the whole, like, how I got to where I am right now.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, but in terms of your question of how do we make sure that we include diverse perspectives, I think that that is really important. I think it's something that people are finally kind of waking up to. CBC is trying to do a very serious job of looking at all different backgrounds and communities and people to work in film, and we're also doing that behind the camera as well, which is really neat. So we're seeing a lot more diversity there. But on screen, yeah, I think that's something that we really need to think about, because, you know, quote unquote, traditional ways of doing interviews or thinking about how to do interviews are changing.
Yeah.
And they need to change.
Yeah.
So I did a film a couple years ago, aired last year, called True Survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a film that I hosted, but I also wrote, and it was in response to climate change and what I was going through as a new mom and how I was approaching it. And one of the things that I felt very strongly about is, okay, The Nature of Things is a science show, yes, but it is an evidence-based show, right? And so it doesn't just mean we're looking at science. We're also looking at Indigenous knowledge and other ways of gaining evidence that are legitimate, right? And so it was very important to have the Indigenous perspective and stories alongside the very scientific people that I was interviewing.
That's a hard bridge to walk. Like, I mean,
absolutely,
kind of striking a balance between providing really accurate scientific information and then engaging with this wide audience kind of in an emotional way, like inciting hopefully meaningful actions, right? Like that's insanely tricky.
And also, you know, science is, yeah, you're doing an interview with somebody who's a scientist and they're talking about, you know, facts and what they've discovered and stuff. But when you're talking about Indigenous knowledge, it has a totally different time frame, right? You know, we're talking thousands of years and stories that they're not expressed in the same scientific ways. And so it's very hard, as you say, to do both and be respectful and give the time needed to talk about long stories. So, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it or can't do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
It just makes us be more thoughtful about it, more creative, more open, and I think that's a good thing.
I agree with you on that one. So in your new role, are there any specific topics within environmental conservation that you're particularly excited to explore? Kind of, I don't know, maybe you're looking to explore some things outside of marine biology, or are you planning to stay kind of within your area of expertise?
Well, yeah, so what's really interesting is how the nature of things works is different production companies will come to us, or say you have an idea for a show, you will pitch it to the nature of things, and then they'll say, oh, that's a great idea, let's go for it, but you bring the team, and so each show is created by a different group of people, and so it's wonderful because we get all these fascinating topics, and I don't have to be an expert on them. Of course, I am a little bit biased that I love water-based, ocean-based, anything marine-based stories, but we're also covering so many other things. So we were just shooting one on microplastics, which was fascinating. We were just shooting one on ultra-processed foods, which was also, like, mind-blowing.
I look forward to that
one. So these aren't my background, but, you know, who wouldn't have a million questions on these? And so I feel like my role as host is to ask the questions that viewers would have,
right?
To bring them in.
Completely.
Yeah. But there is one we're talking about right now, which is a group of young women in Africa from different countries in Africa who have decided that they're going to be, well, they are marine biologists, but they want to learn how to scuba dive and get to know the ocean. And it's an unbelievable story because they're talking about all the barriers for African women to become scuba divers and to be ocean scientists.
That must be a long list in some ways.
Yeah, I spoke to them the other day over Zoom, and it was, they really called it a sisterhood.
Yeah.
And it was just so interesting to hear them talk about what science was to them, because it's not just, you know, people in a lab doing some random experiments. It's like song and dance and story and scuba diving and researching fish, and like it's a whole package and being together and being women. And so that one I'm really excited about because it has a lot of things that I think about, and also a whole other level being in a different part of the world and a different perspective.
So your first episode aired on January 11th, is that right? In that one, you guys traveled all the way to the Dominican, right? Is that something you anticipate for future shows, like travel, or will you just be receive segments that were filmed in other places and then you guys add your 2 cents?
Yeah, so that was a very special film because, as you say, we went to Dominican Republic. We also went to Egypt.
Yeah.
So this is something that we are doing. The hosts are going on location in some films, not all of them, in some films and in for certain parts. So, sometimes a film will shoot here, there, and somewhere else, and the host will just go to one of those locations.
Right.
Which is all amazing, and for the Egypt one, it was essential that I be there because we were looking at the fossils in the desert. But I am very hesitant to sign up for a lot of travel because of my carbon footprint, and I'm very concerned about it. I think about it all the time. The guilt is through the roof. I talk to CBC about it a lot, and I'm always trying to say, listen, is this something that we could do with a smaller footprint?
Yeah.
Do we have to travel for this? Is it absolutely mandatory for this scene? Since COVID, there have been a lot of changes in technology, and maybe interviews over Zoom aren't super visual, but they're possible. So that's something that wasn't available, a couple decades ago, certainly. So I think we have to be more mindful, and it will shift how the film industry does their programs, but it's essential.
Yeah.
So yes, there is currently travel, but I'm trying to minimize it. And this is a good example for the plastics one.
Right.
It's a look at, how microplastics are affecting our world and our bodies. And that for that shoot, they did have to go to various places around the world. But for the part that I was involved in, we just stayed in my hometown of Victoria. And I honestly think that that is more impactful because it was much more intimate. We actually looked at my plastic bag recycling. Like, I took it all out and I sorted it.
Yeah.
And then we went down to a local beach and we sampled microplastics in the water column. We looked at my clothing and how much plastic was in my clothes. And I feel like with big issues, especially something like microplastics, which is ubiquitous around the world, it can be very overwhelming. And so in a way, making it more intimate and more personal and bringing, you know, the viewer into my home, I'm hoping that will be more accessible because, you know, we wear clothes.
We do.
Most of us pick up plastic in some capacity nowadays, right? Like in our groceries, whatever. And so, just talking about it at that level, I think, is helpful.
That's a really nice way to kind of infuse your personal touch into the show. That's great.
Thanks. Yeah. And that's what I'm hoping for. That's, you know, some of your questions were about how are you going to do that. And I really do think that accessibility through intimacy and not to make it all about me, but just to have a little link of being like, I'm this person.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Humanize the science a little bit. I think that's really crucial.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you have any memorable experiences from when your dad was the host of The Nature of Things that you are kind of drawing on and that you drew inspiration from when you decided to take on this job?
Oh, interesting. Well, I mean, he was hosting The Nature of Things since before I was born.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he just retired last year. So it's still like, wow, that's the only role I've ever seen him in, you know, besides all the other stuff he does. But like, that was his job. And he was gone a lot because he traveled a ton for the show and had to film and stuff. So I have memories of him for sure, like in the kitchen at night, trying to memorize his lines. We didn't have teleprompters back then, you know. And sometimes his stand-ups would be like over a minute long, which is insane nowadays to think about, right? Everything's so short. And his, like interview scenes would go on and on and with just two talking heads. It was so different. And that's something that I think about so much because when he started hosting in 1979, there were only a handful of channels on TV.
Right.
Right. And so if you had a TV, you probably at some point saw The Nature of
Things. Yeah.
And it was a very like linking show because people all across Canada could see it.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I mean, most people don't watch TV.
Yeah.
And so people get very personalized shows and they're consuming them on their phones, their computers, very different way to consume media.
Yeah.
So when you think about how are people going to continue watching The Nature of Things, it's going to be in a very different way.
Yeah, that's
and
actually...
So that's one of the things that we're trying to think about as we look forward.
And how do you guys kind of plan on surmounting those challenges?
Yeah, well, this is kind of an experimental year. I mean, we're starting something new, which is like a digital component to The Nature of Things. So we're going to have a few short docs that are different, obviously, from The Nature of Things.
Okay.
And those are going to exist only online.
Okay.
And they're filmed in a different way, which is probably like quicker, faster, more modern.
Yeah.
And we're doing way more social media. I mean, I don't even know if my dad ever did social media for The Nature of Things. It wasn't around.
Right.
But I really do want to say that while the faces and formats of the shows and the social media and all the communication, that might be evolving, the core principles of what make The Nature of Things special and important and the fact that it's survived for 60 years, you know, like,
yeah, something,
the core
there's
principles
something to
are,
it. Yeah.
Are the big deep dives into science, the environment, and what it means to be a human and what are our social obligations as a species in a changing world. Like, those are the real core principles to me which make The Nature of Things unique. Those will remain because they're so important and clearly they've stood the test of time. So we might be experimenting a bit with format, but Okay. But we're always going to go back to the roots.
Right. That's awesome. Yeah, that's actually something that I hadn't really thought about before, right? Like, there are so many streaming networks nowadays. I think one really unique thing about the nature of things is that it is free on CBC Gem, which is, like, an incredible resource.
It really is. Like, yeah. I didn't... All CBC stuff's on Gem for free. Yeah. Anybody can watch.
Like, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, they have incredible shows. Yeah. And
super high production quality. What's that? Super high production quality for, like, everything I've seen, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really neat. And I think you can get Nature of Things for the last, like, maybe 6 years on Gem right now. So, yeah, it's great. And I don't know how many people still watch Nature of Things on TV. Mm-hmm. I mean, it airs once a week. But you can see the programs at any time on Gem. So that's great.
Yeah. So you're co-hosting the show with Anthony Morgan. Did you know Anthony before you guys started?
No, I had no idea who he was, and we met for the first time when we were doing a press release saying that we were the new host.
Wow.
And I know, but since then we've worked a couple times together, and so we've gotten to know each other a lot better since then, but I feel so lucky because he is a fantastic person. I mean, he's obviously an excellent communicator. He's so passionate about science, but he's just like a stand-up person, which is, thank goodness. And I just feel so blessed because he's a wonderful colleague.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. For listeners who don't know much about the show, what's Anthony's kind of specialty?
Yeah, so Anthony comes at it from like a social science background. He's really interested in what drives humans to make decisions. And so it's kind of like a psychology bent.
Okay.
He's doing his PhD right now on that very thing, decision making.
Okay.
But he's very engaged with how do you make science interactive and fun and accessible to people. So he loves doing experiments. And he just wants everybody to think like a scientist.
You guys seem like you're great.
And have fun while doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems like you also really bring an aspect of fun to your interviews.
Aww.
Yeah. Well, seriously.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, he is way more, like, he is hilarious. I'm not a funny person, but he is really
Oh, come on. Catch yourself. So
but I love that we're really different. Like, I'm much more focused on nature and, you know, like the environment, that type of thing. And so I think we complement each other in that way. He's also from Toronto, so he has a different, you know,
yeah, that's
Canada,
really interesting.
Whereas I'm very much from BC, so that's a plus.
Yeah. A beautiful dichotomy. Yeah. Have you guys had anyone approach you or do you know of shows in the past that were related to any kind of outdoor recreation, like, or sports in general, like, if not outdoor recreation?
Outdoor, probably.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That was just a personal question from...
Yeah, I'm sure. I can't think of, like, one specific off the top of my head.
No, but, that's all good.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about is your audience, which is primarily outdoor enthusiasts,
yeah,
like people who like getting out there. And you guys are one of the first groups to see changes in the environment.
Yeah.
And you've probably all noticed things that have changed because of climate change, seasonal changes, maybe hibernation of certain animals that are changing. You know, like, you guys have eyes out there. And so it's really important for you guys to speak out about it, because not everybody sees that firsthand. So I really love that you have this podcast, and I encourage everybody who's a listener, you know, to speak up, to write about it, to take pictures, to get the word out on the things that you're seeing out there.
Yeah. So, you know, I know you're... Dad has interviewed people like who were doing blockades and things like that. Do you see yourself delving into any kind of like environmental activism on the show and how that is, you know, portrayed in the media?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all about that. I'm not shy about that. I would be up for, if I really believed in something, and obviously, you know, for the nature of things, it would have to be probably backed by science and evidence and that. But why not? And also, it has to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know, with the shows coming up, you know, how much we're going to deal with the activism, but everything that happens now has to be about action. You know, the science is in, the data are in,
yeah.
We know where we're headed. Now it's about action. If we have any hope, we have to move. And so we're going to be talking about it all the way through the nature of things. And I don't think that it's not considered radical anymore. Like,
yeah.
It's we know about it. And for those of us who grew up knowing about the Anthropocene, climate change, ocean acidification, all of this, it's not news to us. It's just, it is the current reality. And so I think CBC is good. I think the nature of things has always kind of pushed the envelope on these conversations. And at this point, it's like, yeah, pretty common knowledge. So absolutely, I'm going to be talking about that. And the film that I made, True Survivors, I think we get into some real deep stuff. Some pretty existential stuff too, personally. So I hope to be able to bring that to more shows.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit more about True Survivors and what that was all about for you?
Yeah. So this, it all started when I was writing a pitch to The Nature of Things, and I talked to my sister about this idea of survival. And when we were growing up as kids, our favorite game to play was Survivor. And this was way before the reality show, uh-huh. Right? We would just go down to the beach with my dad, and he would say, okay, you need to find food and water and shelter and light a fire. Okay, go. And then for the next few hours, my sister and I would run around the beach and try to unsuccessfully make things and find things. But I loved it. It was so much fun. And I thought about this a lot when I was older and these reality shows started coming out, like Naked and Afraid,
yeah.
And Alone and Survivorment, right? And like, you turn on the TV today, there's so many of these shows. And I was kind of like, why are we so obsessed with this idea of survival? Do we all secretly want to know if we'd make it out there in the elements, right?
Yeah.
Like, I just actually wanted to know. So this is kind of what my pitch was about. And then while I was writing it, COVID hit. So this is 2020.
Right.
Everything kind of changed. And that fall of 2020, in September, my kids were going to go to school for the first time. And the smoke from the wildfires south of our border was so thick that we were deemed in international news to have the worst air quality in the world.
Oh, my God.
In Victoria, Vancouver.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you remember, but it was terrible. So
yeah.
The schools were actually shut down. Like the daycare was shut down, and then my son's school, they had to shut all the windows and doors. Like, it was crazy, you know.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Everywhere, all you could think about were these huge changes that were happening.
Yeah.
Then the next summer is when we had that heat dome,
and
like 600 people died in
BC.
And then the atmospheric rivers that took out highways, changed the course of rivers.
Yeah.
So I remember that time, and it was, nobody could talk about anything else. It was all about climate change.
Yeah.
And it was an incredibly unsettling time.
Yeah.
Because you have these, like, the pandemic, and then you have these forces of climate change. And so suddenly my original pitch was not at all interesting, and I changed it to, okay, survival. What really matters right now is the big question on everybody's mind that I'm talking to: are we going to survive climate change? And so that's what the film is about. And I was terrified to make it because I honestly didn't know what I was going to discover. And the last thing I wanted to do was make a film about climate change that would be depressing. Because who's going to watch that? That's not going to help. So I basically was kind of like the guinea pig. I just was asking my real questions that I had at that time.
Well, folks, we
just dropped our call with Sarika.
The interview does continue, but here is a song break.
So my daughter is really into this Kenny Starr song right now, Save Our Waters.
Okay.
And Kenny Starr is a local artist.
Oh, awesome.
Who will save our waters? Save them for our great-granddaughters. Save them for our great-granddaughters' sons. Tell me, who will save our waters? Save them for our great-granddaughters. Save them before all is dead and done. Hey, hey, oh, ho, oh, oh, oh. Say no, hey, hey, oh, 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 please don't say no.
Further studies reveal that those cancers were part of the petrochemical business, petrochemical business, petrochemical business.
And them just go splitting the land. Split the land for bitumenly. Carve her up and spit her back in poison. And faster than them rivers can run. Leaks bring up a tail and come undone. The grandfathers watch the young ones die. Oh, well, water catches flame. Water's catching flame. Water's catching flame.
Looking for an audioscape to put your mind at ease? Landscapes by Dune is a musical journey through sampling and field recording. From the busy streets of Toronto to BC's picturesque landscapes, the Belgian artist recorded an array of sounds during his travels across Canada. Landscapes will be released on Pop Guitari Records Bandcamp on December 8th and will be available on all streaming platforms on December 15th. For more information, check out at Dune as Dune on Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show, but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
Tune your radio to the CITR 101.9 FM on a Tuesday, specifically at 1 p.m. or 11 p.m. for saxophone Hello Primiti or saxophone Len Wee. Hosted by moi. Accompanied with the improvisationalists, saxophonists, composers, and musicians of our great era since the 70s. Featuring artists such as Anthony Braxton, Albert Ayler, Solange, Ghostface Killah, Ornette Coleman, Sonny Rollins. That's 1 p.m. or 11 p.m. on a Tuesday to listen to saxophone a la Primiti or saxophone Lenui.
Welcome back to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. This is CITR 101.9 FM. We pick our chat up with Sarika Cullis-Suzuki and continue talking about her endeavors as a documentarian outside of the nature of things.
Well, anyway, yeah, so, okay, so basically I was saying that I was thinking about these questions were reflecting what I was actually going through.
Yeah.
As a new mother facing climate change. And so, yeah, we get into it. I mean, I didn't know what we find, but we started in New Mexico in White Sands, and we look at the ancient footprints that were discovered recently, like very recently,
right.
That showed, wow, humans have been here way longer than we thought, for like 24,000 years. These footprints are that old. And so what does this mean, right? Like, it means that humans were able to adapt to a changing
yeah.
climate. And then when you think about that, you think about, wow, our early hominid ancestors, you know, 3 million years ago, we have been surviving through unbelievable fluctuations
yeah.
in the environment, in climate.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're still here today means that we were able to do it.
Yeah.
So that, to me, is one of the most wow, aha moments. And when I look to the future and I look to the fact that we're now experiencing a climate change and we have to get through it, knowing that we've gone through it before
yeah.
is hugely comforting. Now, I obviously, the rate of this climate change is like nothing. Like, it is so fast.
Yeah.
So it's a huge challenge. But knowing that we have survived through heat, through ice
yeah.
before, means that the ability runs in our blood.
Right.
And that is really energizing.
Wow.
So that was a really nice place to start.
Yeah.
And then from there, we go to Atlin. We talk to the Tlingit people there about their relationship with salmon.
Oh, cool.
We talk to a river scientist who talks about the changes in glaciers and how new salmon are coming in because
right.
there's more water. And
yeah.
And we go to Haida Gwaii and we talk to Gwaganod, who is a Haida elder, and she talks about how in her memory, of her ancestors' memory, they remember a time when Haida Gwaii didn't have cedar. It was a pine forest. And then before that, it was a tundra.
Oh.
And I know. And then we talked to an archaeologist who was like, well, yep, all the evidence is exactly in line with what she just said.
Wow.
And to know that they have survived and now they are a thriving group of people because they were able to adapt with the environment
yeah.
and to live within the environmental needs. It was just like, all of this stuff I found really, really inspiring. And then we go to Lytton.
Mm-hmm.
And Lytton is a town that was burned to the ground
yeah.
in 2021.
Yeah.
And I was really, really nervous to go there because I didn't know what we were going to find. Turns out nothing had been done. There was still nothing there. Like,
wow.
It was still burned to the ground. There was no development or
yeah.
anything. But a little town next to it, Kanakabar, was thriving. And so this is a small group, an indigenous community, and they have so much foresight. And he used to be chief. His name is Patrick Michel. I talked to him, and he was saying, you know, we said, what would our ancestors do? What did we always do? We look to the future. We realized what we needed to do. We came together. And we tackled the problem. And what they've done is they have created energy independence.
Wow.
Through run of the creek. They have energy. They have created all their own housing. They have all their own food, including livestock.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, and they're taking their own data. They have all the technology to monitor like wind speed and rainfall and temperature.
That's incredible.
And it's mind blowing. And so they're like so far ahead of the rest of us, and they have no outside funding. The federal government doesn't give them money. The provincial government, they have done it all by themselves.
Wow.
And so to me, I was like, wow, okay, us in the bigger cities, Victoria, Vancouver,
yeah.
so much more resources and money.
Oh, yeah.
What is our excuse?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that to me was a wonderful place to kind of end because it showed us that we have no excuses. Time's
yeah.
up. And there are people who are making huge changes and strides to becoming the future we need to see.
Wow.
Yeah. So inspiring. And then there's also one moment in the documentary, which people tend to tell me about, which is this very intimate conversation that I have with my dad. And the director was like, we need to have it in there. It's going to anchor the film, and it's kind of the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
So we are sitting around a campfire, and we talk about what it was like when my dad found out I was pregnant. And it's really, really intense, because it is true. It's exactly what happened. And basically he said, why would you bring a person into the world if everything I told you, like, you believe what I told you, right, about our future? And it's a very intense conversation, but it's, I think, important. At the time, I was like, this is so cringing, right? But now I realize why it's important, because I think it reflects what many of us live with, which is this internal struggle between two realities. The reality of what we know is likely going to happen because of climate change, and the reality of having to live day to day, right?
Yeah.
And still be a person who can experience joy and love, right? And try to figure out how to live with that knowledge of potentially devastating things, which we're already seeing happen. So,
wow.
Yeah, I it sounds really, really depressing, but I also think in a way it's freeing to just be like, this is my reality. I grew up always being told and knowing the state of things ecologically.
Yeah.
And now here I am faced with this decision with my own kids.
Yeah.
What am I going to choose?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting moment. And I think it's something that, you know, nobody wants to talk about climate change, but we don't really have an option.
Ain't that the truth?
Our reality. Yeah. And I just wanted to give Daniel one more shout out that when I started at UBC, I think it was 2006, he told me that climate change was going to be the issue that defines my generation.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely right.
Yeah.
And it's going to be everybody's issue. Well, it is everybody's issue right now.
I'd say it's defining my generation as well.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Well, you seem like the right woman for the job of the nature of things. Really, congratulations. You've done fantastic work. I'm, extremely impressed. And, the amount of education you've gone through that now you're willing to share with the public, we're very lucky to have someone like you sharing information with us.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you for saying that. I'm really, I'm humbled with this opportunity. I know that it is a huge honor to be and privilege to be in this position and to represent a show that has been on air for over 60 years.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna try my hardest, that's for sure. But I wanted to thank you for your very thoughtful questions and for following along and being curious and putting out this important show.
Well, it's the least I can do. So remind us, when does the show air?
So there's new shows now every Thursday at 9 o'clock on CBC.
And you and Anthony kind of alternate hosting?
Yeah, so I think it's not really like him one week and me one week. It's just kind of how it falls. But one of us will be hosting most of the shows. And you can also stream them anytime for free on CBC Gem once they're out.
Awesome.